The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Bridget Earley is titled Unique Christmas Traditions to Start with Your Family This Year. There's a reason why the holiday season is considered the most wonderful time of the year. It's one of the few occasions where we press pause on the hustle and bustle of the always-on world we live in, gather with friends and family members, and take part in time-honored traditions. Now, chances are you and your loved ones have your own way of doing Christmas, and that probably involves some old Christmas traditions, from gathering around the fireplace for a family-friendly game night, to baking insanely delicious Christmas desserts while listening to a playlist of classic Christmas songs. But just because you've done things one way doesn't mean that's the only way, which is exactly why we've gathered some unique Christmas traditions to start with your nearest and dearest this year. Some of these delightful ideas come straight from our families, i.e. having a Christmas movie marathon while wearing matching pajamas, while others you can steal from around the world to bring joy. For example, you could take a cue from Mexico and place poinsettias in the house. You could decorate a German-inspired Christmas tree, think creative garland made from popcorn and cookies. You can make and mail handmade Christmas cards like they do in the UK. Or, as is custom in Australia, you could serve shrimp as part of your Christmas feast. Not to mention that some of these Christmas activities are just plain fun. We highly recommend adding a Secret Santa gift exchange to your holiday party. No matter how many you add to your festivities, 1, 5, even 10, all of these Christmas traditions will make your celebrations even more merry, so consider it our gift to you. Collect memento Christmas ornaments. One of the most touching ways to mark the passing years is to honor each holiday season with a custom ornament, either made by hand or purchased at the store. Whether you've moved or sent your first child to kindergarten, you'll be flooded with memories each time you pull that trinket out of storage to hang it with care. Play holiday-themed trivia. Put a festive spin on game night with a few rounds of Christmas trivia. The winner gets bragging rights, or you can make it interesting with a prize. Extra milk and cookies, perhaps. Make a do-it-yourself photo booth. You might associate them with weddings and other big events, but making your own photo booth is a great way to create mementos to share. You won't need much more than a digital camera or iPad on a tripod, a background to tape on the wall, a wildly patterned blanket or finger-painted paper, both work, bright light bulbs to flatter all your angles, and a little floor space for posing. Throw in some inexpensive funny hats and fake mustaches to tap into your family's silly side, and you've officially got a party going on. Listen to a holiday story by candlelight or Christmas lights. Challenge yourselves to put all screens away and cozy up for some quality time as you listen to a Christmas-themed tale together while you craft, make cookies, or simply relax. Listen to an audio play version of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, or if a more modern option is more your family's style, there's author David Sedaris' hilarious and true modern classic Santaland Diaries about his time as a Macy's elf. Countdown with an advent calendar. Tap into that holiday buzz by ticking off each passing day, counting down to the main event. It's an old Christmas tradition the kids especially love, but more modern versions, like wine and beauty advent calendars, appeal to adults too. If you've missed the first few days and need to catch up by eating a week's worth of foil-wrapped chocolate in one night, don't worry. We won't tell Santa. Buy matching Christmas pajamas. The night before Christmas, don identical jammies for an adorable family portrait. Sit down for a special brunch. Once presents have been torn through, gather the family together for one last holiday celebration, a special brunch. Menu options are boundless, from French toast to lox and bagels to egg casseroles. If you want to tap some other holiday traditions, take a nod from Australia and serve shrimp. are turned a ruby red pomegranate, which symbolizes abundance and life. And of course, don't forget to add a yummy Christmas cocktail like cranberry Prosecco punch or spiked hot chocolate. Pick out a tree. Whether you trek to a tree farm, run down to the street corner, or peruse a local nursery, there are plenty of ways to make the experience a memorable one. Don't want to commit to a live tree? Consider getting a pine wreath instead. Or tap into your do-it-yourself side by creating a washi tape tree on the wall. Decorate the tree. Once you've selected the perfect fir, reserve an afternoon to decorate as a family. Though you probably have a selection of string lights and baubles at your disposal, this tradition originated in Germany, where revelers adorned their trees with red apples and later strings of popcorn, candles, white candy canes, cookies, and dolls, according to Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas by Ace Collins. To infuse a little personality into the tradition, give each family member a mini tree for their bedroom and task them with decorating it in a singular theme that speaks to their personality. See who can find the pickle ornament. While this quirky custom, sometimes called Weinschottgurke, supposedly has German origins, it's more likely an American Midwest tradition, according to the New York Times. What's the significance of this ornament? Traditionalists say the first child to find the pickle Christmas ornament gets the first present, an extra present, or the job of handing out the presents, plus good fortune in the year to come. Get creative with Elf on the Shelf. To the dismay of parents everywhere, this modern Christmas tradition remains wildly popular with kids. Though undeniably fun for little ones, it's a bit of work for moms and/or dads, who are encouraged to come up with creative ways to stage their family's elf each night. The upside? Your elf watches over the little one's behavior, reporting back to Santa, so he can craft his naughty and nice list. Participate in a toy drive. Adopting a child through a local nonprofit organization, such as Toys for Tots, is another way to incorporate a charitable component to the holiday. In most cases, they'll provide a small wish list, then you do the shopping and drop off wrapped presents at a predetermined location. Sip mulled wine. For an extra special holiday treat, whip up this popular European winter beverage. It's essentially a warm red wine flavored with spices like cinnamon and clove. Write letters to Santa. This sweet Christmas tradition is actually relatively modern, originating in the late 19th century, according to Time. How exactly did children start penning letters and lists to Santa? Cartoonist Thomas Nast published some of the first visual representations of St. Nick in Harper's Weekly, including an 1871 image of Santa Claus sorting mail at his desk. In the image, one pile is labeled Letters from Naughty Children's Parents, while another reads Letters from Good Children's Parents. While your kids will undoubtedly want to pen their own, encourage Christmas goodwill by answering a letter to Santa as a family. Through the USPS Operation Santa program, you can read letters and then send a toy to a lucky kid out there. Watch a tree lighting. Though Christmas trees were originally illuminated with candles, the tradition poses a serious fire hazard. As such, today's modern trees are adorned with much safer string lights, either white or multicolored depending on personal preference. According to Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas, this adaption became popular shortly after the advent of the light bulb, when one of Thomas Edison's employees decided to apply their invention to his own holiday tree. Tour neighborhood light displays. Outdoor light displays first gained traction in the years following World War II, when greater production made them more affordable and accessible to the masses, according to Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas. Suddenly, there were illuminated Christmas displays both indoors and out, complete with lighted ornaments, bubble lights, and even lighted Santas. In some locales, these Christmas displays have really exploded. For a truly unique experience, see if you can find a local spot that synced their lights with popular Christmas ballads. Decorate with poinsettias. According to Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas, decorating with poinsettias is one of the few Christmas customs that originated in North America, in Mexico specifically. In Christianity, the red flowers symbolize the blood shed on the cross, while the green leaves represent eternal life, but for many, the bloom is simply a beautiful symbol of the holiday season. Use it to add color and spirit indoors or out, from your front porch to your mantle. Just make sure it's out of reach of pets if you buy a real one, as it can be poisonous if ingested. Do holiday crafts. Whether you do-it-yourself gifts, make your own holiday cards, assemble festive garland, decorate stockings, or create an entire Christmas village, hosting a family crafternoon is one of the most fun ways to get into the spirit. Turn on some classic Christmas music, warm up a mug of hot chocolate, and get to work. To spread a little holiday cheer, hand deliver your handiwork to elderly neighbors who could use a little company. Have a Christmas movie marathon. As if you needed another excuse to binge watch something on your favorite streaming service. There are plenty of holiday movies to watch on Netflix this year, not to mention the endless feel-good fare on Lifetime and the Hallmark Channel. Browse a local Christmas market. This popular tradition in both France and Germany is replicated all around the world, where shoppers meander through the seemingly endless stalls at Christmas markets and villages to shop for the best Christmas gifts, all while sipping on hot chocolate or mulled wine. Participate in a Secret Santa. This tradition goes by several other names, including Pollyanna, and it's played by families and office co-workers alike. How does it work exactly? Participants select a name at random, usually out of a hat, then shop for a small present, typically under $20 or so, for that person. Sometimes offices may opt for a white elephant or Yankee swap instead. The concept is similar, but in these cases, participants draw gifts blindly out of a bag, trading prizes until the game concludes with the last pick. Mail holiday cards. This Christmas tradition first became popular in England around the middle of the 19th century, quickly spreading to the rest of Europe and then to the United States, according to stories behind the great traditions of Christmas. At first, these cards coupled seasonal illustrations with greetings, but today's modern take usually features family photos, too. If you're feeling inspired to get a little crafty, many nursing homes accept handmade cards to cheer up residents who may not have any family to celebrate with. Alternatively, you could do something similar for first responders, including doctors and nurses, police officers, and active duty military. Make a gingerbread house. Whether you buy your own kit or build a gingerbread from scratch, one thing's for sure. This is a sweet, pun intended, tradition the whole family will adore. If you're really feeling confident in your abilities, up the stakes by entering a local gingerbread house competition. Host a cookie swap. Christmas cookies are a holiday staple, but there's only so much baking one person can do. Expand your horizons by hosting a neighborhood cookie swap. Each person bakes a few dozen of a single variety, then everyone gets together for an evening of festive merriment to split the haul. Feast on the Seven Fishes. Though one of the oldest Christmas traditions from southern Italy, it remains a popular one on the tables of Italian Americans today. The feast, also known as La Vigilia in some circles, occurs on Christmas Eve and is a grand meal, including, you guessed it, seven different types of seafood, ranging from shrimp and octopus to clams and cod. Go caroling. According to stories behind the great traditions of Christmas, caroling is an ancient word that refers to dancing or singing songs of praise and happiness. In the Dark Ages, it was a year-round practice, but later fell out of favor since it was considered a pagan celebration. It wasn't until the early 16th century, when Martin Luther embraced caroling, that it became a common practice during the Christmas season. This is when tunes that we still sing today, like Silent Night, were first composed. If you're feeling inspired, don't just limit yourself to your immediate neighborhood. Turn up somewhere that could really use an extra dose of holiday cheer, like outside of a hospital, for example, but check whether they're welcoming outside carolers first. Volunteer at a soup kitchen. If you're looking for another way to give back, consider volunteering to cook or serve a holiday meal at your local soup kitchen, food bank, or shelter. You can also find other volunteer opportunities near you by visiting Volunteer Match. Make a Yule log. This French confection, also called the Bûche de Noël, is a log-shaped cake traditionally served after midnight mass on Christmas Eve, according to stories behind the great traditions of Christmas. Serve panettone. Alternatively, opt for another traditional dessert. This one, called panettone, has Italian origins. It's a yeast-leavened bread that's typically made with raisins, candied fruit peels, almonds, and brandy. Even if it doesn't grace your own holiday table, it makes a great gift for neighbors and coworkers. Attend Midnight Mass. If you belong to a Christian denomination that offers it, and you can keep their eyes open long enough, Midnight Mass is a cozy, often candlelit way to celebrate the reason for the season. If your church is taking their festivities virtual this year, you can make it feel more intimate by mimicking the ambiance in your own home. Turn down the lights, cozy up on some floor pillows, and light plenty of candles. Our next article by Grant Reiner is titled, What Happened to Halston? The designer is the subject of Ryan Murphy's new Netflix show. Few figures have made a more significant impact on American fashion than Halston. His clean, minimalist, and functional garments were hugely popular through the 1970s and 1980s, and the man himself became a true celebrity thanks to his affiliation with people like Liza Minnelli, Andy Warhol, and Bianca Jagger. The influential designer's life is the subject of a Netflix series from Ryan Murphy, aptly titled Halston. Ewan McGregor plays the lead role in the show based on Stephen Gaines' biography, Simply Halston, which was published in 1991. Initially renowned for his work making women's hats, Halston's designs eventually expanded and he made waves in the fashion world when he partnered with major brands and department stores. With more eyes on the iconic designer's life and the legacy he left after dying of complications from AIDS in 1990, here are the facts you should know about Halston before watching Murphy's new series. Halston cut his teeth in Chicago before becoming a major figure in New York. An excerpt of Simply Halston, published in Vanity Fair, gives a thorough overview of the man's early life. Originally born in Iowa, Roy Halston Frawick first found fashion success in Chicago and moved to New York in 1958 when he was 26. He was renowned as a milliner, initially working for Lily Dache before eventually moving to Bergdorf Goodman. He was probably the greatest hat maker in the world, an absolute magician with his hands, influential fashion editor Diane Vreeland said of Halston and Simply Halston. In the late 60s, Halston branched out on his own, starting a boutique in Manhattan. Then he began to experiment with other types of garments. In the Courier Journal and Times piece cited by Vogue, Halston explained his philosophy around clothing design. The point is to be comfortable. If you have nice legs, by damn, you want to show them. We have to abandon the idea we all have to look alike, he said. We have to do what's best for ourselves. That's the secret of fashion. While he didn't invent it, he's known for pioneering the use of ultra suede and made hybrid shirtwaist dresses inspired by men's dress shirts. He also created halter dresses in a variety of colors. Huge stars like Liza Minnelli and Elizabeth Taylor loved Halston and his pieces. During Halston's heyday, he was adored by some of the biggest stars of the 20th century. He was close with people like Warhol, Jagger, Minnelli, and Elizabeth Taylor, among others. Minnelli, for instance, wore one of Halston's creations, a yellow dress, to the Academy Awards. Jackie Kennedy, meanwhile, donned a Halston hat for her husband's 1961 inauguration as president, making an iconic fashion statement. She helped increase his cultural cachet significantly. Kennedy even put a small dent in the hat, trying to keep it from flying off in the wind, which other designers reportedly copied in their own pillbox hats. The relationship between Halston and Warhol inspired both men creatively. Per Biography.com, Halston appeared on several of Warhol's TV programs, while the artist's flower prints inspired several of his designs for dresses and scarves. Halston and his celebrity circle frequented New York's historic Studio 54. The 30th birthday Halston helped throw for Jagger was legendary because, according to Vanity Fair, Halston rode a horse around the club. Many of Halston's famous friends appear in Ryan Murphy's Netflix show. Liza Minnelli is played by Krista Rodriguez, Joel Schumacher by Rory Culkin, and Elsa Peretti by Rebecca Dayan. He was in a rocky relationship with artist and designer Victor Hugo. Per Vanity Fair's Simply Halston excerpt, Halston's personal life was rather bleak. In 1972, he met a young man from a call service who went by the name Victor Hugo, then 24. The pair began living together, and Halston brought him into the fashion business, where he began to dress the windows of Halston's boutique. This caused controversy in part because a previous boyfriend of Halston's, Ed Austin, also held that job, but was abruptly fired. According to Gaines in an interview with Now Next, the relationship between Halston and Hugo, played by Gianfranco Rodriguez in the Netflix series, was oftentimes chaotic. I think it was a real love of a sort. It wasn't the kind of romantic, sweet, tender, caring love. Victor was stealing stuff out of the house when Halston was dying. They had to lock him out of the house, Gaines said. But Halston liked being humiliated and having the shock value of having Victor around. It was a whole other side to Halston, and Halston was a very sexual person, and so was Victor. Some around Halston attribute his eventual downturn to Hugo, per Vanity Fair. Hugo enabled the high-octane partying lifestyle that Halston found through Studio 54, and had a volatile personality of his own, even painting over some of Warhol's original portraits and eventually stealing art from Halston's home. That Venezuelan call boy was his downfall, Andre Leon Talley told the New York Times. He was a grifter who clung on like a parasite, like a barnacle on a ship. Eventually, Halston sold his name and began to struggle personally. As Gaines told New Now Next, Halston entered a personal spiral that involved drug use and anger issues. In 1973, he sold his company to Norton Simon, Inc. for roughly $12 million in stock, seemingly signaling a move towards mass market sales. In Vanity Fair, Gaines wrote about Halston's mounting personal drama. He also seemed a bit more petulant and on edge, quick to lose his temper and spit out invectives like moron or idiot at those who displeased him. No doubt Halston's fuse had been shortened because he was snorting cocaine on a regular basis, he wrote. Later, per a New York Times piece from the era, JCPenney approached Halston in 1981 about a collaboration, and he developed a more inexpensive Halston 3 line for the department store. Either Halston nor the retail giant JCPenney built their reputations by doing the unusual, but when they recently joined forces, the move surprised many in the fashion industry, June Weir wrote. Roland Ballister, who produced the Halston documentary, said that these decisions were broadly unpopular within the circles that had once loved Halston's work. The fashion world took it as a grave offense, Ballister stated. It wasn't just, okay, we're going to slowly ease you out because you've changed direction. It was this very dramatic, we're done with you, he told nonfictionfilm.com. Despite these business successes, Halston grew frustrated, and in 1984, he bought back his company, which was then owned by Playtex. According to the Washington Post, Halston regained control of his made-to-order and ready-to-wear business. The type of partnership Halston did with JCPenney has since become more common in fashion, as high-end designers like J.W. Anderson and John Elliott have done affordable collaborations with brands like Uniqlo and The Gap, respectively. At the time, though, it was relatively unprecedented. Halston died in 1990 due to complications from AIDS. In the 1980s, Halston contracted HIV, which eventually developed into AIDS. According to an LA Times obituary, Halston passed away at age 57 in San Francisco. Specifically, he died of Kaposi sarcoma, a kind of AIDS-related cancer that he battled for 18 months. Per the Associated Press, one of Halston's final acts was to sell the black Rolls-Royce he called his dream car and donate all the proceeds to fund AIDS research. His eponymous brand continues to sell clean, elegant garments that draw on his unique contributions to the world of American fashion. He didn't think of himself as an artist, even internally. He never talked about his work in that sense, Chang told nonfictionfilm.com. At the end, he said very humbly before he died, "I'm just a dressmaker. That's what I do." There's something really refreshing about that. Since then, he's been the subject of numerous films. Given Halston's impact on fashion, his celebrity circle, and the drama that permeated his life, it's no surprise that he's been the subject of much media. In addition to the Halston documentary and Ryan Murphy series, a 2010 doc titled Ultra Suede in Search of Halston was also released. Additionally, his work has been showcased in museum exhibits, including one titled Silver and Suede that highlighted his relationship with Warhol, Hats Off, which focused on his milliner work, and an expansive showing at the Nassau County Museum of Art. The Halston trademark is currently owned by Excel Brands, Inc. Halston's company has had several different owners since his death. Per Women's Wear Daily, or WWD, it was briefly under Revlon, Inc., which just produced Halston fragrances. The clothing was revived in 1996 by Tropic Tex, and Halston proceeded to change hands several more times, including briefly receiving an investment from Jimmy Choo co-founder Tamara Mellon in 2007. Though that relaunch fizzled, a new line was launched under the Halston umbrella, dubbed Halston Heritage, that was based on archival Halston designs, according to WWD. Presently, the Halston and Halston Heritage trademarks are owned by Excel Brands, Inc., a company which also owns the license for Isaac Mizrahi and Judith Ripka. Halston is considered by many to be one of the first true stars of American fashion, and wherever the industry goes in the future, it's likely that you'll still be able to detect his fingerprints. Our next article by Lacey Johnson is titled, "These Are the Telltale Traits of a Narcissist." Narcissist has become a buzzword we love to toss around, inspiring a frenzy of articles, blog posts, online quizzes, and memes. Also a swarm of accusations. Nearly everybody thinks they know one. There's the image-obsessed friend who is in love with their own reflection, the arrogant boss who gloats over their own ideas, and the two-timing ex. But do you really know a narcissist, or have you been using it as a catch-all phrase for someone who has a moderate dose of these tendencies? A personality disorder that exists on a spectrum, extreme narcissism hosts a maze of trickery that transcends your run-of-the-mill self-absorption. If you lean in too closely, a narcissist becomes an energy vampire, making a circus of your life, the kind that causes you to perform acrobatics in order to please them. The most common traits that narcissists possess are dismissiveness, entitlement, and grandiosity, including blatant defiance of your boundaries, jealousy and resentment when someone else captures the spotlight, and outrageous expectations for how their needs should be met, while grasping for anyone to cloak them in validation, of course. So if you suspect you have a narcissist in your circle, or might be in a one-sided relationship with one, whether or not the dynamic feels toxic, read on. We talk to the experts to unbox what narcissism really is, the charm, the gaslighting, the seduction, the injury, and the twisted truth, as well as how to deal with a narcissistic person. So, common misconceptions aside, what is a narcissist really? Defined by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, need for admiration, and lack of empathy, a hallmark of narcissistic personality disorder, or NPD, is an extreme religiosity to an individual's sense of entitlement, self-importance, and uniqueness. It's their needs that matter. They take self-absorption to a high altitude, convinced that they are so rare that few are capable of understanding them. In other words, their feet are seldom on the ground. The disorder can manifest in the form of wild ambition coupled with success, or swing the other direction, in which they may become melodramatic or believe they're always the victim. When you're talking about a true narcissist, this is someone who exaggerates their self-perception and deems themselves as being superior in some way. And while it can appear quite alluring at first, you won't find the kind of consideration and regard for other people that you might expect from the average individual. They may come across as charming, kind, and extremely likable initially, but behind it is someone who is seeking to get their needs met, says Dr. Judy Ho, PhD, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist and author of Stop Self-Sabotage. And you will see that darker part of them the minute you are unwilling to meet their needs. Dr. Lena Durhali, licensed psychotherapist and author of My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer, says that the key to understanding narcissism is quite simple. Extreme narcissism is not being cranky with your spouse and having low empathy for them one day or even every now and then because you're stressed. Everybody does that. It's more so this behavior that touches all areas of a person's life, shaped by a lack of empathy and desire to truly understand the needs of others. With narcissism, there is a spectrum and everyone falls somewhere. One of the most common misconceptions about narcissism, aside from the assumption that it's primarily identifiable by instances of extreme self-absorption, is that a person either is or isn't. Psychologically speaking, narcissism is a personality trait that every human being occupies to some extent. Everyone you know lands somewhere along the narcissism spectrum, and interestingly, research shows that a moderate amount of self-centeredness and confidence is healthy, lending an engine of ambition and resilience to one's functionality and goals. But nearly any personality trait, when driven to the extreme, can become pathological and sick. This is when the behavior is so egregious that it becomes diagnosable as NPD, which only makes up about 1% of the population. This deeply ingrained, inescapable pattern pervades extreme delusions of grandeur, jealousy, and power struggle, particularly in the realm of relationships. Incidents of cruelty and violence are often involved. So let's say you have a character in your life who breezes or torpedoes through their days, both good and bad, with a haughty air about them and a chronic dismissal of your feelings. You could be fraternizing with a person who has NPD, but it is much more likely that the accused is someone who is simply positioned on the higher end on the narcissism spectrum. This is typically referred to by mental health professionals as a person with strong narcissistic traits, and though it isn't necessarily someone whose personality is entirely void of empathy, their persistent narcissistic habits and patterns can still wreak havoc on their life and yours. Let's zoom in on the personality traits of someone with high narcissism. A narcissist charges through life as though everything they embody, from their ideas to their problems, is a higher priority than yours. Your life just isn't as relevant or interesting to them, and you'll know this by how they constantly steer the conversation right back to their own narratives. They love bathing in themselves, their accolades, dramas, ideas, and even victimhood. In fact, you may know every detail of their life, from the glory to the gore, but they may barely know your highlights. You might hear the language of, nobody does it like I can, or in cases where the narcissist is wallowing in their troubles, it could be, nobody understands what I'm dealing with. Or they may remind you over and over of how strong they are, says Dr. Ho. They don't believe in boundaries. Boundaries? You won't be needing those. Narcissists see other people as pawns to get to where they want to go. They may never admit it, but they are the most important person in the room, and everyone else is just an object to manipulate or a place to dump their problems. So your boundaries mean nothing to them, says Dr. Ho. When they want something, they expect automatic concession, whatever the day, the hour, or the circumstances. And if you deny them what they want, that's like stomping on an ant pile, because another person's connections, empathy, resources, and time are their right to dominate. If you assert yourself, prepare to encounter their wrath. In fact, it may blow up in a puff of smoke, leaving you confused as to how you suddenly became the bad guy. When you give a narcissist any kind of critical feedback whatsoever, even in the gentlest way, they bite back extremely hard, acting as though you attacked them or wronged them, said Dr. Ho. The type to launch smear campaigns or call upon humiliation tactics, Dr. Ho says narcissists who are the highest on the spectrum can be downright cruel when challenged, growing violently insulted and offended easily and often. A narcissist will often imagine that other people are belittling them or trying to harm them, even if the person is simply trying to set a small boundary or give constructive criticism during a business meeting. They often react with rage or a defiant counterattack, and it can get ugly, she says. Dr. Dehrhali adds that perceived is the key word within this dynamic. Oftentimes, what they think is an attack isn't even an insult whatsoever, but an accidental challenge to their ego. This extremely angry overreaction is called narcissistic rage. Admiration, praise, and validation, those make up a concoction that is their literal lifeblood. The minute you compliment them, it intoxicates them so much that they will almost pry for more validation, says Dr. Ho. So if you say to them, "Oh, you're so funny," they will keep working on that, wanting more and more of the praise. But the same sort of applies to when they get comfortable with you and bring all of their negativity to you. They love for you to validate or enable whatever brings them attention and confirms their uniqueness, even if it's negative. Another trait is that a narcissist has a hard time letting others shine. Another hallmark of a narcissist is that, though they reek of bravado, they can't let anyone else be awesome. For example, let's say one of their acquaintances from high school is recognized for building a successful startup. The narcissist will ruminate on why that person deserves the notoriety and will be sure to tell observers of all of the skeletons that person has stowed away in their closet. Extreme narcissists live in a pattern of jealousy and the refusal to just accept that another person is thriving. There is this constant irritation when it comes to sharing the limelight and a need to take this person or that person down a peg, says Dr. Ho. The signs will take different shapes depending upon the circumstances, but the common thread is entitlement, a sense of self-importance and a blatant disregard for the boundaries, feelings, needs, priorities, and schedules of others. One sign your friend might be a narcissist is that they never seem happy for you. Narcissists may bombard you with calls and texts to unload all of their dramatic tales, even during your most inconvenient hours, because it's always their hour. You may respectfully ask that they pause the communication because you need to rest up for an important meeting the following day, but that's seldom received well. Some kinds of narcissists will come across as extremely needy. If there is always a huge problem or drama, everyone has to focus on them, pitying them, running to their rescue, and helping them clean up their messes, says Dr. Ho. A narcissist's sense of entitlement is extreme, with unreasonable expectations of favorable treatment. They will always find a way to be the center of everyone's universe, good or bad, says Dr. Ho. If you're in a narcissistic relationship, their patterns are predictable. There are three phases within the narcissist's relational maze: love bombing, devaluation, and discard. The cycle typically starts out with vivid, fragrant bouquets of flattery and praise. How appreciated, brilliant, incredible, and gorgeous you are, and how much your presence in their life means to them. This is called love bombing, and it can be intoxicating to a victim of narcissistic abuse. It may feel euphoric, but it lands with a dark intention. Because if you stay close to a narcissist, it tends to lead to whiplash-inducing moments where the charming, gracious, romantic person who sees so much beauty in you suddenly has another face, an enraged, entitled, accusatory one. And you meet it the minute they don't get their way in the slightest. This is the devaluation phase. The love bombing and devaluation phases may loop and repeat for the duration of the relationship. The love bombing act is how they keep people around. It's a rather abusive dynamic. The more you get involved with them, the more the dark side manifests in situations, so you'll start to get more of the devaluation. But if they lose you and it scares them, you'll get the love bombing all over again, says Dr. Dehrhali. She adds, it's confusing because you think, oh, there's this truly nice, loving person in there who cares about me so much. But you're always walking on eggshells and feeling extremely anxious because you never know if you're going to get Jekyll or Hyde. Finally, there's the discard phase, which is not something everyone who is in a relationship with a narcissist will experience. You don't always get to the discard phase because some narcissists might remain in a relationship with someone for a lifetime, going back and forth between the cycle of love bombing and devaluation. It's when they have no use for you anymore that you see it. If you're discarded, it's likely because they've invited someone else into their parade of self-importance, someone who has a brand new way of making them feel like a ringleader. It can be very shocking for some people because they may have gone around and around with a narcissist for years trying to make it work, says Dr. Dhurhali. Behind a narcissist's grandiose sense of confidence is insecurity. There is a desperate, grasping energy among narcissists, and it most often derives from pain and instability. Think of a narcissist like a house of cards. One small nudge to their self-esteem and the whole structure falls apart into a messy pile, leaving you wondering, what in the world just happened? Why did that one comment upset them so much? Believe it or not, narcissists do not love themselves the way they want you to believe they do. They aren't really that fearless person you see. Sure, they love bathing in all forms of self-adoration, but it's only because they're starving for it, specifically because it's the opposite of how they genuinely feel inside. The overconfidence and charm is likely all an act. They are probably deeply suffering from low self-esteem, which is why they have to work so hard to overcompensate, says Dr. Ho. So what causes a high spectrum of narcissism? Dr. Ramani Dervasula, licensed clinical psychologist and author Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Narcissistic Relationship, says the disorder is multi-determined, and while family and relational factors ultimately explain the lion's share of narcissistic patterns, including overindulging, undernourishing, and super authoritarian parenting styles, there is also the possibility of biological predisposition, as well as the narcissistic individual having been jolted by a deeply negative experience. A history of trauma can be a contributor in some situations, as that can impact development of empathy and regulation. Society also doesn't help with its focus on materialism, consumerism, competition, and validation seeking. She adds, at its core, narcissism is simply pathological insecurity that manifests as validation seeking and antagonism. So any early environmental conditions, such as neglect from parents, that foster pathological insecurity place a person at risk for later narcissism. The ultimate curveball? They often don't know they're narcissists because they think everyone else is. The resounding theme is, this is not about me, it's about you. Your fault, your problem to fix, your lack of attention to something. A lot of times a narcissist will glance around them and accuse numerous people within their social circle or family as being narcissists. They are masters of projection, often oblivious to the ways they abuse, entangle, manipulate, and poison others. Because of the way narcissistic people operate and think, they have a tough time connecting with people in a deeper way, without inviting chaos and conflict in at some point. Because of this, it's hard for them to sustain relationships over time. They may be the person who wants lasting romantic love so badly, but they don't realize that what they are seeking is someone to worship them in an unreasonable way, says Dr. Ho. She adds, you basically have to worship the ground they walk on, validate them, and coddle them. And if you are way too successful, they are always going to have issues with you. They may even act like they are supportive of you if they know doing so will make them look good or help them with a connection. But secretly, another person's greatness infuriates them. And how do you deal with a narcissist? For one, be gentle with yourself. Narcissistic abuse often causes a person to feel like they are going crazy, because narcissists have a knack for making everyone in their self-created circus swallow the blame. But once you know, the less likely you are to be gaslighted. Second, vow to stop getting sucked back into their charm, because remember that, on the other side of it, their toxicity holds strong. Narcissists know how to put on a show, whether it's a fun-loving one or one that will provoke you to feel sorry for them. They are often wonderful to be around initially, but when you truly get to know them, they are the opposite of charming, says Dr. Ho. Never underestimate a narcissist's ability and willingness to keep sliding that facade back in place each time they have upset you or lashed out at you cruelly, especially if it means they can still use you in some way. Finally, memorize the patterns of their vicious cycles and fold it into all of your interactions with them. Oftentimes, the way you learn to manage them is to tell them how amazing they are, that they were right and you were again wrong. This may allow them to sort of reset and shower you with love all over again, but the dangerous truth still remains underneath it. And you will have then reinforced your willingness to forgive their self-absorption. They will be that charming person again, but only until the next conflict, says Dr. Ho. Is it wise to confront their behavior? Confronting a narcissist will almost certainly result in a battle, at least initially. So the decision depends upon the severity of their narcissism and if they currently exhibit any desire to self-reflect. But if you do opt to call them out, Dr. Ho suggests using the sandwich approach, which begins with affirming them. If you've got someone who seems like they want to move the needle, have the conversation, but start it with something really complimentary. You could say something like, "I really love this about you, but you know what would make our relationship even more amazing? Or, you mean so much to me and I appreciate you, and I know you may not realize how this comes across, but when you say this, I feel," she says. Because a narcissist is only receptive to small amounts of negative feedback when they have been brushed with a fresh coat of flattery, ease into building your case against their harmful patterns. Never go right into the conversation with criticism, adds Dr. Ho. Is a narcissist capable of falling in love? They're certainly capable of forming superficial relationships. In fact, they are masterful at superficial friendships and often have a broad collection of them. Narcissists almost always keep lots of people around them, but it will be people who can benefit them in some way. Essentially, they're users, says Dr. Dhurhali. Dr. Ho says it's common for people with low self-esteem or poor identity to hang around the narcissist the longest, because they are the easiest, most impressionable prey. They could be trained to serve the narcissist's glorification of themselves. As for romance, Dr. Dhurhali says a narcissist is always the most charming person you've ever dated. Well, initially. It's very romantic and wildly intoxicating. You're so flattered at the lengths they'll go to be with you. The narcissist's romantic partner gets off on that, the pursuit and the chase, as well as convincing you to adore them. But once they become comfortable, bored, or have won you over, the dynamic shifts dramatically to the devaluation phase and perhaps the discard phase, she says, and it can be unbelievably shocking to their victims. What about narcissistic parents? Lastly, narcissism in a familial dynamic is the most complex and delicate. Dr. Dhurhali says that when looking at narcissism in parents, one of two things generally happens. The parent will overindulge the child, or they will constantly force them into situations that the child badly does not want to be in. For example, the little girl who was forced into ballet or piano lessons for years, even though she sobs before every rehearsal. The narcissistic parent generally sees the child as an extension of themselves. They don't really care about the child's needs, but that the child is meeting their needs. Sometimes this can even result in a dynamic where the parent goes through periods of ignoring the child and withdrawing love in order to punish them, she says. So is there any hope of a narcissist sustaining loving relationships? Of them being healthy partners, friends, sisters, or parents? Possibly, if they are willing to self-reflect and honestly work through the damage they cause others. But sadly, one of the traits of being a narcissist usually precludes that, says Dr. Ho. Still, while hope isn't necessarily probable, it is possible. If you have a person in your life with strong narcissistic traits and you truly love them, you shouldn't necessarily give up. As they let their guard down more and more, and as you continue to affirm them through it, and as they are more receptive to owning their role in any conflict or chaos, you may begin to gradually make progress, says Dr. Ho. Okay, so it's potentially treatable, at least somewhat. Manageable is the more appropriate word, though not in the majority of cases. Dr. Ho stresses that narcissism is a personality disorder as opposed to an actual illness, so it's not treatable necessarily. If an individual genuinely seeks help for it, it's not that it will ever go away, but the narcissist can become more cognizant. So if you back that with a true desire to have better relationships, they can begin to catch themselves being entitled and self-absorbed, she says. With a narcissist, it is seldom ever a gentle, gradual awakening of self, but a life-altering impact that shoves them into a hallway of despair and hopefully change. They usually have to hit rock bottom and suffer as a result of their entitlement and self-absorption, such as an extreme loss of assets or prestige, or being abandoned by someone who tired of their unrelenting abuse. It's usually a huge business failure or a relationship that goes awry. They may realize that they in fact did love that person, but push them away with their selfish, toxic behaviors. It takes something deeply traumatic to jolt a narcissist and cause them to realize that they need to heal and work on themselves, says Dr. Ho. It's rare, but it can be done. Accept that fixing them is not your responsibility, but maintaining your sanity is your own. If you're going around in circles with someone who is especially high on the narcissistic spectrum, know that getting through to them is not going to be an easy, straightforward task. But what you can begin to do? Withdraw your energy and power from their boundary violations, demands, jealousies, and tantrums. You have to remember that you are in control of your life, no matter how they may treat you or react to you. You have to start dictating what they can and cannot get away with and own how you will respond to them, says Dr. Dhurhali. Dr. Ramani adds that if you can find a way to avoid being a narcissist's emotional punching bag, you may be able to channel some compassion for them, but never at risk of your own peace of mind. It's really difficult to live life angry, contemptuous, victimized, disappointed, and forever needing validation, so compassion is the best path. However, that does not mean trying to rescue them or remaining in a toxic relationship, she says. Sure, it's easier said than done, but try to remember in most cases, it's not your responsibility to drive away their personal demons or satisfy their cravings for admiration and praise. Stressing the importance of remembering that you are not the narcissist therapist, Dr. Ramani emphasizes that when you rush to their rescue in order to avoid their wrath, you risk chipping away at your own mental well-being. So considering this, it may be wise to stop juggling their problems. Because while you cannot change them, you can absolutely change how you respond to them. And though you might benefit from professional help to guide you through the healing process, remember that your life is your own show to run, no one else's. Because narcissist or not, people only have as much power over you as you are willing to give them. Our next article is titled, Why Do I Keep Dreaming That I Miss a Volleyball Serve? I used to play volleyball in high school, and I was known for having a pretty great serve. I haven't played volleyball in more than 16 years, but to this day, I frequently have a dream where I'm getting ready to serve. I throw the ball up to hit it and miss. Of course, everyone around me is staring and whispering. I've always written it off as an anxiety dream, but is there a deeper meaning I might be missing? Signed, the server. Dear server, one thing that fascinates me about our sophisticated unconscious mind is how it holds our memories and associations since birth. It's like a database filled with information that's unique as a fingerprint. Our dreams provide a wealth of possibilities for choosing what we want to say to ourselves and how to say it. By taking you to a volleyball court, the place where your ability is shown, your dream may be a way of saying to yourself, I can do this. I suspect that 16 years ago when you threw up the ball to serve, that's what was in your mind. Now, though, you seem to be referring to some behavior or skill that you used to be pretty great at, but no longer feel in the same position to execute well. Please keep in mind, even though missing a key moment in a sport is a very common dream, if this was one I kept experiencing, that's an area I would want to investigate. I am also struck by how, in your words, you've always written it off as an anxiety dream. Ask yourself, what is something that you used to be good at but no longer feel as capable or confident in, which causes you to feel anxiety? If you have some resistance to acknowledging your anxieties, that's just what might spawn a dream like this. In this case, your dream's goal would be to bring these feelings out into the open. To help you associate this dream with a specific event in your life, let's add another layer onto the questions to ask yourself. Besides looking for a recent situation where you feel anxious and less proficient than you remember, consider the element of judgment suggested by the feeling that everyone is staring and whispering. If we look at the overall theme, this feels like a discussion about expectation. Have you recently set out to do something you used to be good at and find you are no longer as talented at it? This typically leads to judging yourself and imagining disapproval from others. The disappointment, self-evaluation, and imagined criticism from others all trigger anxiety. Change is inevitable for all of us. How we manage ourselves through those changes is more important than the way some of our abilities may wane over time. The key is to tap back into that same great potential you still have inside you, this time by accepting change without judgment. For example, it might be a good time to figuratively toss the ball to others, if you will. Are you comfortable asking for help? Finally, using a play on words, this dream suggests serving. What comes to mind when you think about serving? Could you have been using the term metaphorically? Do you feel like you're serving the people in your life? Moreover, are you someone who typically accommodates, so much so that people expect you to say yes to any request? If that hits a mark for you, did you recently say no to someone when they required something of you? If you did recently turn down a request, it might explain how and why you say, "Everyone around me is staring and whispering." Have your recent actions caused you to feel exposed or evaluated in some way? Serving can have many associations, however, so let's not get stuck there. How about serving as an offering up an idea, such as a recent situation in which you served up an idea in a meeting? Did others witness your idea take a dive instead of flight? The possibilities I've set forth here all illustrate completely different solutions. In the first scenario, in which you feel less capable, the solution will be to serve the ball to others or to push past anxiety about judgments and ask for help hitting it over the net. In the second potential analysis of this dream, serving others is not in fact the goal. While those around you might be surprised at first as you exercise your right to say no, people's ideas about what to expect from you will change, in which case missing the serve is a good thing. Our in-house dream analyst, Lane Delphin, is here to help you make sense of everything. In a twice-monthly column for Oprah Daily, Lane draws upon her decades of experience to explore what a reader's dream is trying to tell them. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.